Welcome to Across the Desk, where we discuss entrepreneurship, small business, and everything in between. Hey, it's Elizabeth Plouffe, and welcome to Across the Desk. Today's wise words, and today I will be talking to you about a terrific book I just finished reading by best-selling author of Selling the Invisible, Harry Beckwith, and it's called The Invisible Touch, The Four Keys to Modern Marketing, more engaging, practical, and down-to-earth insights from America's most trusted marketing expert. Now, I don't know exactly what makes Mr. Beckwith America's most trusted and down-to-earth expert, but I've really enjoyed the few books of his that I've read. One was You, Inc. that he wrote with his ex-wife, and I've done a podcast on that, and it was quite good. But I really enjoyed this book. It was really well done. It's from a few years ago, so some of the references are a bit dated, but honestly, overall, the advice was really practical and some great insights. So I usually do a little flick of all the post-it notes that I've stuck in, but I've decided to be more environmentally friendly, so now I have magnetic bookmarks. Doesn't sound nearly as good, but I can definitely make it flap if you want to. So I went in. I must have at least 10 of these bookmarks in here for some really interesting pieces of advice. What it's broken down to is research and its limits, the fallacies of marketing. Then it goes into what is satisfaction, and then he talks about the keys to marketing. The first key being price, the second being brand, the third being packaging, and the fourth being relationships. So I'm just going to read a bit to you because I found it really interesting. So I'm a bit of a research geek on top of that. I have a tech startup that I'm putting together. Very excited about that. That's going to be coming soon. Won't show up on Wise Words, but you'll be hearing me talk about it somehow. And so when somebody talks to me about data to substantiate their claims, I give that a lot of credibility. And I usually double check the data as well, depending. I'm also actually reading right now Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's fascinating. And it talks about the subconscious act of thin slicing. And what that essentially means is when you meet somebody or see something or whatever, you immediately do like a 30-second assessment that you don't even realize you're doing it. It's a lot faster than 30 seconds. And if something sticks out, then you should be listening to that and why. And it's all about data and how it impacts your decision-making process and all these incredible things. So I when I'm reading that right after reading this, oh, just lots of great stuff for me to geek out on. So the first thing I'm going to read to you is about research and its limits. And he talks about data misleads. An imaginary scene in Burbank, California, 1952. Eight representatives are waiting patiently in a small room that has what they do not realize is a one-way mirror on a wall. Finally, a young man arrives, the facilitator for their discussion. He engages them in some ice-breaking questions and then poses the question of the day. Imagine an enormous park. In the center, picture a four-story medieval castle with turrets painted a soft blue. Leading up to the castle, imagine a wide street with stores on either side. Imagine a perfect small American town in 1915, except that these stores are immaculate, freshly painted, and about two-thirds the size of a normal building. As you walk down the street, people in Goofy and Mickey Mouse costumes walk up to you and greet you happily. In various parts of the park, you find a ride through a jungle, a submarine trip, cars that race around a track, and other rides. Would you be interested in such a park? Would you fly 2,000 miles to visit it? Would you pay $100 a day for your family to visit? Almost certainly the answers to those three questions would have been maybe, no, and absolutely not. And Disneyland and Disney World might never have been built. This kind of research, the kind that asks the questions you might well ask, is plagued by three insurmountable problems. The first, the question it asks, are hypothetical, and life is real. We spend our hypothetical time and money in a much different way than how we would spend real time and money. What we actually do is often nothing like what we said we might do. The second problem with "would you like this" research is that what you describe and what you deliver are not the same thing. The hypothetical Disney researcher's word picture, vivid though it was, couldn't accurately capture Uncle Walt's vision. The final problem is the one this tale of Disney suggests most vividly. The more innovative your idea, the smaller the number of people who will understand it. And people have a great trouble imagining that they will buy something they cannot understand. Another example. Picture yourself trying to explain the personal computer and then asking your listeners if they would be interested in one. Only that tiny sliver of the population known as innovators would say yes. Everyone else would likely say no. In fact, in the early stages of most innovative products and services, almost everyone does say no, making no a not very meaningful survey answer. Even more important, the more innovative the idea, the more uncomfortable most people feel about it. Truly new ideas make people uneasy. When Fred Smith trotted his idea out for Federal Express by his experienced and intelligent business professors, they thought it would never fly. Federal Express was too different. You can see the pattern. The more innovative the idea, the less likely it is to survive this kind of scrutiny. And yet the more innovative the idea, the greater the potential for success. Research supports mediocre ideas and kills great ones. And I found that really interesting because it's so true. And I've worked in a variety of jobs and done a couple of businesses now, where when you are presenting something that is outside the norm or slightly, you know, innovative or what have you, or you yourself are the thing that is innovative about the idea, right? So women in business, granted that, you know, we are no longer the exception, but we're certainly not the rule. And women who own businesses, even less so. And I also now have two businesses. So I have my communications business and I also have a tech startup. And I can honestly say that over the last couple of months where I have started to share that I have a tech startup, you would think that in this day and age of 2019, there wouldn't be these surprised eyebrows that shoot through the roof, but there are. And that's kind of disappointing. But what they're also saying is, if you have something that you're trying to present, if you're trying to be innovative and iterative or suggest something completely new, you need to add a piece of familiarity to it. You don't want to at any time really trigger the limbic system, which is the sort of the primal decision-making part of the brain, right? The limbic system on every level is always evaluating things for a threat. You know, are you a friend? Are you a foe? Are you going to eat me? Are you going to try and stab me? You know, all those great things. And a lot of it is vestigial, you know, for the most part anyway, except for all the stuff going on in the U.S. right now. And in Canada, I won't pick on the U.S. We've had our fair share of crazies as well. For the most part, you don't have to evaluate every person you meet for whether they're going to draw out a sword and stab you, or you're going to have to have a showdown like the Wild West. You can typically go about your day and your limbic system remains a little bit quiet. So one of the things that really surprised me about this was my immediate reaction of, oh, well, this would work. If I were to take my idea and attach it to something more familiar, people are going to be more likely to listen. It's still going to be innovative, still going to be different, but it's how I present it that matters. And definitely having the research to back it up. But it's also how you do your research and how you present things that really makes a difference. So if you're listening to this and you're in a business that, you know, likes to be disruptive and what have you, that's awesome. But I would stress, and I would say this to more and more clients as I deal with them now after reading this book, that it's always wise to find some kind of familiar point for people to relate to. Definitely don't back off from being innovative and making things different and all those amazing things. But find something that feels as comfortable as Mickey Mouse now does. There's definitely value in doing that. And here was the other thing that I found really interesting, and it probably speaks to me more than maybe some folks, I don't know, because I've always been the one that got in trouble for not following process and for thinking differently and whatever. And I'm not tooting my horn. That's just the way I'm built. And I didn't think it was any big deal until I had a few years under my belt in normal business. And then it became a bit of a problem. So going into the fallacies of marketing chapter in this book, he's got the fallacy of imagination. So what I'll say here is, or what I'll read to you is, we value imagination in business, but barely understand it. And our misunderstanding stifles our imagination. We see imagination as the uncommon ability to create something totally new. Test this definition against every creation that you consider imaginative. However, and what do you discover? Totally new creations are not totally new after all. As one vivid example, imagine American rock fans on April 12, 1965. That afternoon in 56 Chevys at Coney Island, 64 Corvettes racing down the California coast and everything in between, they first heard something utterly new. The Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man, which is an awesome song, by the way, with its riveting guitar line. The song immediately became part of the spirit of that summer and that time. Millions bought the single and the album to keep it forever. We had never heard anything like it. Or had we? Consider the elements of the recording for a moment and what those elements suggest about how we imagine, innovate, and create. First, the song itself wasn't created by the Byrds, but by the poet laureate of folk music, Bob Dylan. It was not, however, an obvious choice for a fledgling rock group. Its lyrics were far more esoteric and sophisticated than those of any top 40 song of the day, and their implicit drug theme, "Take Me for a Trip Upon Your Magic Swirling Ship," was forward-looking as well. Second, Roger McGinn's ringing guitar, which creates the memorable intro, wasn't common in 1965, but McGinn was not the first rock musician to use that particular guitar sound. Like almost every English-speaking person under the age of 40 in 1965, McGinn listened to the Beatles. And like every musician, McGinn had good reason to listen intently. He wanted to figure out the Fab Four's secrets. One afternoon, he noticed a unique sound. It was George Harrison's guitar, and a sound McGinn loved but barely recognized. What was that sound? McGinn wondered. McGinn got his answer in a movie theater. There, watching the Beatles' Hard Day Night, he spotted Harrison's hands, a very distinctive guitar, a Rickenbacker 11-12 string. The next day, McGinn rushed out and bought one, and Mr. Tambourine was on his way. Third, McGinn admired artists other than the Beatles. Like many early rock musicians, McGinn trained in the classics, and this has always been my contention. I'm not reading this from the book, this is my opinion. My contention is that within music, nothing is really new and innovative. If you go back to Bach and Beethoven and Vivaldi and those that came before and those that came slightly after, the vast majority of music is based on that. Anyway, the arrangement echoes of McGinn's seminal influences, Bach. Or Bach, if you want to be politically correct. Fourth, to serious students of music, McGinn's genius was not in those elements. It was how he mixed them in the studio. Producer Terry Melcher and McGinn mixed this song with another song in mind, The Beach Boys' Don't Worry, Baby. So, skip over a little bit. And so what was this remarkably innovative song? Like virtually all innovators, McGinn did not create something utterly new. He simply combined existing elements in ways no one had combined them before. The breakthroughs we salute and which often produce extraordinary returns for their imagineers, the personal computer, traveler's checks, and indexed mutual funds, a bit of a dated reference there, never occurs from nothing. The imagineer does not build by combining genius with air. She builds with existing ingredients. Breakthroughs, as McGinn's recording illustrates, very rarely are original entities. They are unprecedented combinations. Innovations combine things that would never have been combined, often because no one believed the combination would work. And so it continues on, but I find that really valid. And my husband said to me many, many years ago, he said, you know, as far as my level of creativity and what have you, he said, you know, you don't come up with much that's original on your own, which most people would go, oh, but he's right. He said, but you make other people's stuff so much better. And I think it's how we view the value of imagination that, as applying it to our business, it doesn't have to be big and audacious and whatever for you to pursue it. If you are looking at things, and I do this all the time, if you're looking at things and you can see a new way to use them or what have you, I think that's equally valuable. And there is an imagination component, but as Mr. Beckwith says, it's all about how you combine it. And that's part of my tech startup as well, which is probably why this particular chapter resonates with me. I'm not really creating anything shiny, freaky new, but I am taking elements that have never been put together before to serve an underserved community. And that on its own is innovative and interesting. And hopefully I'll be changing how certain services are delivered because of it. You know, thumbs up. We'll have to see. So it goes on and on, in a terrific way. I really liked this book. There's a lot of great value in it. There's not necessarily action items, but there are ways for you to apply this to your business. There are definitely ways that you can use the ideas, that he offers to identify any challenges in your marketing and promotion of your business, and different ways that you can evaluate ideas and take all that stuff on board. And oh, this was a really cool one. So if you're a service provider, I don't know about you, but trying to market services is a pain in the ass. It is definitely a huge challenge because you don't have a lot of images to support your service. There's only so many ways you can package things, and finding a differentiator can be a real challenge. And so he talks here in the brand chapter, why you are not opium or Fruit Loops. So I'll end up with this one because I'm a service provider, and thankfully my other business is a product, which is much easier to market. Woohoo! So many service founders strike out in search of the perfect name. They fail because they try too hard. They try for the name that captures everything about them, particularly their superiority, and that resonates with the creativity and surprise of names like Fahrenheit, Apple, Creative Kid Stuff, or Go Edu. They end up frustrated because they start out wrong. Yes, they should explore the jungles for exotic or offbeat names. Their search will assure them that they have covered all the territory and may inspire them. But these explorers must also remember that service names, like services, are not products. The typical product possesses one single trait. It is tangible. As a result, we buy products for their inherent qualities and their symbolic ones. The man who buys a Coach briefcase, a cross pen, or an Hermes tie buys it partly because of how it performs and partly because of what the product says about the owner. Many people wear product brands, and the savvy manufacturer makes sure that others see them. A Mercedes designer makes sure its symbols are in place so the car clearly announces, "I am a Mercedes." Services, by contrast, are invisible to everyone. We do not try to keep up with the Joneses' choice of broker, orthodontist, family therapist, or internet service provider because we have no idea who they chose. We use services almost by stealth. Indeed, our relationships with therapists, doctors, lawyers, and priests are protected from public scrutiny by laws and rules of evidence. Who knows, or cares for that matter, which accountant does your taxes, which lawyer drafts your will, which dry cleaner presses your slacks, or which mutual fund companies manage your 401k. With few exceptions, we do not wear services like badges of status or means of self-expression. Services differ from products in another way that influences their naming. Control. You own the product you buy. You control it. Your services, however, are more apt to control you. The doctor or dentist determines what you need and when and how you receive it. If you seek advice from a service, you find yourself at the advisor's mercy. How do you argue, for example, that the statute of limitations does not apply to your proposed legal claim? We crave control but feel a lack of it with services, so we feel less comfortable in our relationship with services. And for me, that was a really profound statement, and partly because you really need to take that on board when you are dealing with clients if you are in a service-based business. And they don't mean control as in like an ironclad tightness over what's happening. But services are unpredictable. You know, I met with a client a few years ago, and he said something along the lines of, it was a website design and a marketing plan and some social media stuff and a whole whack of things. And he looks at me and he says, "So I need you to complete all this work, put it out to the public, and have it making me money within 6 months." Now, if you look at the scope of the work that I just described to you, a complete website redesign, establishing social media profiles, connecting with customers, potential customers, creating content, all of those things, that alone can take 6 months unless you are a massive organization. And even then, you have at least 2 months worth of work, depending on how the client engages with you and gives approvals and what have you. To top it off, unless you already have a social media base. So if you are somebody, for an example, I'll choose Brené Brown, only because I think she's awesome. But success on social media can be influenced by what your success is outside of social media. So if you are active with TED Talks and books and established credibility, and you're being interviewed on Oprah, and you're having all of these outside influences that the world already knows you, then it's really quick to establish a presence through social media and have more success with that. If, however, you are like this fellow that I was meeting with, who had sort of abhorred any kind of online technological advances, when I asked him about his CRM, he handed me his phone, and I said, "Well, where are the rest of your contacts?" And he said, "Oh, I think they're in my email somewhere." So he'd kept up no ongoing communication. He didn't really have a strong presence outside of his immediate circle. You're going to need at least 6 months to get people's attention because you've never had it before. And so when he said that to me, I said, okay, well, first and foremost, nobody can promise you to have all of that work completed, have everything created and going out for you, and having it make you money within 6 months. And anybody who does that is a liar. And I said, second of all, I wouldn't advise actually starting any of this work until you get your CRM, which is a customer record management, sorted out. So because right now you've got nobody to tell. And when you are service-based, this is one of the reasons why it's crucial, especially if you have a small offline community, to be understanding that communication services in particular, I'll speak to that experience, will not save your business in a very short, quick turnaround. If you're in a crisis with your business and things are going down the toilet pretty quick, you're going to lose money, what have you. Social media is not the way to save your business. Social media and communications, more importantly than social media, need to be a part of your business plan from the very beginning. Those type of support services are crucial to any business success, right? They just are. And if you don't pay attention to those foundational services as part of your business plan from the very beginning, then especially when you're in a crisis situation, that's going to really influence how you perceive that service and how you understand the amount of control and influence that service actually has. He way overestimated what anybody could do to save his business. That's for sure. Not to say it's not worth trying, absolutely, but you have to wrap realistic expectations around that. So continuing on with Mr. Beckwith here. Here we go. So we crave control, but feel a lack of it with services. So we feel less comfortable in our relationship with services. We need their reassurance that they will use their control intelligently and in our best interests. With few exceptions, our choice of amusement parks, comedy clubs, and some restaurants, for an example, we need to know the service is serious, experienced, consistent, and reliable. We now come to the final and perhaps the most important distinction between services and products, the aspect of play. Granted, we use some products as tools, a Subaru station wagon or a Craftsman hammer, for example, but we buy many more as toys. We choose even some of our more practical tools, computers, cars, and clothes, to name three clear examples, for the fun the manufacturers have engineered or branded into them. How else do you explain? Oh, and he's referencing a really old version of the Mac, so we don't even go there. But rarely do we choose services playfully or frivolously. We are not looking for a moment's fun from lawn services, motels, airlines, financial advisors, or remodeling contractors, or communications people. Fun sounds like a waste of our time and money. With some products, frivolousness is not only welcome, but the driving force. Consider Pet Rocks, Green Bay Packer cheese heads. I don't even know what that is. I'm assuming it's those foam things or something like that. And so those types of fun things don't exist among services, except those that entertain at children's birthday parties. And people take that purchase seriously. As a result, it is rarely wise to choose a playful or frivolous name for a service, which is his point here. A service that violated this rule, not surprisingly, is a famous one that sells toys, Toys R Us. Well, that makes sense because you're selling products to have fun. Anyway. Prospects regard most services as serious business. A service must appear serious. Names like Red Pepper, Opium, or Purple Moon work perfectly for products with fun attached to them. Names like those will usually not work for a service. Anyway, it continues on, but what I found really interesting about all of that is on the back end of his discussion about naming your company is the perception of services and what we as service providers have to be very cognizant of, and the stereotypes and the prejudices that people may have against what we do. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but you have to be really understanding of what your client is asking for when they secure your services. And you have to be cognizant of the fact that they are investing their hard-earned business money in what you do, and that you have to not do anything, hopefully, to trigger a limbic reaction where they feel threatened, and we're back to the whole, you know, sword through your gut kind of thing. So anyway, this book just really inspired a lot of different thinking. I bought it at a used bookshop. I'm sure it's still available online. Just having a look on the website here, and he says it's got 100 best business books of all time. Must be one of the lists he's on. It says here, Harry Beckwith advises businesses and speaks at conferences and business schools worldwide. Oh, he's got a spelling mistake on his website. That's kind of funny and ironic. Where his New York Times best-selling books, translated into 23 languages, are required reading. His marketing strategies for his financial professional services and high-tech clients, and apparently they're on the Fortune 200 list, have received the American Marketing Association's highest honor. I don't know. I just liked his books. I would put him with Jeffrey Gitomer as far as the practicality, and I kind of liked the intellectual component and the science behind it. Anytime somebody can prove something to me with science and data and facts, I'm a happy chick. So it's Harry Beckwith, The Invisible Touch. You can also look for my other podcast, which was Harry Beckwith and You Inc., which was a really good book. I'd recommend it. If I can pick up another one of his, I certainly will. And you can take a look. If you've got any comments, if you've read some of Harry's stuff and you really liked it, I'd love to hear about it. Or if you've got a book in a similar vein that you want to recommend, love that too. I have a bit of a reading problem. I take just about any and all suggestions. And just to reassure you, as far as a service goes, I don't talk about crappy books on my podcast. Or if it is a really crappy book, I'll tell you it's a crappy book. I don't believe in wasting your time with that. I don't get any kickbacks or any payment or anything like that for doing this podcast. I do it because I have a reading addiction and I hate wasting my time on bad books. Makes me nuts. So I do recommend this one. I think you get something out of it. You can see the rest of the Wise Word podcast list. And if anything grabs your attention there, you got a question, you can shoot me an email, elizabeth@mcvcommunications.ca. And that's pretty much it. I hope you're having a fantastic day. Like, again, if you've read something that you want to recommend or have me review, let me know. I'd love to hear it. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Across the Desk. You can follow me on Twitter @MCVComms, Instagram @MCVCommunications, or visit MCVCommunications.ca to see where else I'm hiding out.